And public hearing. This is item number 13, sport fishing regulation proposals. And Craig, I will turn it over to you, good sir.
No, nothing. Craig should have his Hunter orange on.
Good morning, commissioners. For the record, Craig Burley, Fish Management Division Manager, and with me today on this briefing is
Rich Childers of the Fish Program.
And Dave Lowry with the Marine Fish Science Unit in the Fish Program.
So thank you. Yes, today we'll be briefing you on the sport fishing regulation changes that are being recommended for consideration for the 17-18 year. And what we'd like to do is talk a bit about the process that we've used to get to this point, the timeline and public involvement that has been undertaken. We'll brief you on the proposals that we're recommending, as well as public comment that we've received to date online, and then we'll have an opportunity for public comment. So this is the third year of the three-year process that the Commission enacted in 2014. This was designed to provide an opportunity for staff to focus on regulations more closely and to also reduce the volume of regulations that we're bringing before the Commission on an annual basis. You'll recall in 2014, the Commission addressed regulations in fresh waters of the Columbia Basin. Last year, you looked at freshwater regulations in the coastal and Puget Sound regions, and this year is focused on marine fin fish and forage fish and shellfish rules. So we started this process in mid-March of this year and looked at accepting proposals from the public. Those were taken online. We sent an email out to our list of interested parties. We issued press releases and provided an opportunity for folks to submit proposals on our website. And we did that through the end of April. Then during that May, June, July time period, agency reviewed all those proposals and developed a package that included proposals we recommended go forward for further consideration, as well as those that we recommended not go forward for further consideration. That entire package was put out on our agency website for public comment, and we've been taking public comment between August through the end of October. We also, at that same time, had three public regional meetings in August, and we're here today for the public hearing. We'll then take what we hear today, as well as all the written public comment, and we'll be coming back to the Commission in December with final recommendations for your consideration. Those regulations that are enacted would take effect in July of next year. So during this process, we received 66 regulation proposals. Again, staff reviewed those proposals, and 11 are recommended to go forward with further consideration. I will mention, though, that all of the public proposals that we received were posted on our agency's webpage, and we've been taking comments on all of the entire package. So in this package, we have a table of technical changes that we're recommending. These are not directly policy changes, but more technical in nature. We'll have 8 shellfish proposals and 2 marine finfish proposals. Now I'll turn this over to Rich Childers.
Good morning, Commissioners. I will be presenting the rule change proposals from the shellfish world. There will be eight of them. And the first set of rule changes that I will are the technical changes that we are not going to go into in detail. And there were nine technical changes that we submitted, and these changes have no bearing or do not alter the current regulations. They're more of what we would call a housekeeping changes, clarifications, and so forth. And these come up periodically as we're reviewing WACs and so forth for a process like what we're presenting today. The primary purpose of those is for clarification. Some of them are, for instance, True North versus Magnetic North and stuff, some older language that needs to be improved. We received no public comments on any of the technical changes. So I will now jump into the actual shellfish proposals. And the first one is a possession of another food fish and shellfish limit. And this is a rule change requested by enforcement. And it's there to provide the ability to track food fish and shellfish that's in possession of fishers. And basically what we will be enacting through this rule is if you're in possession of more than a limit, let's say two limits or so forth, you're going to have a written statement that is signed by the fisher that actually captured that shellfish or food fish, stating that yes, they have given them to you or so forth. So this is going to help our enforcement when they contact folks, fishers that are in possession of over limit. We did get some opposition to that through comments, three oppositions. And in summary, they're stating that the rule is not needed and could lead to unintended and unnecessary violations, and it could be confusing to the public. If I could summarize the opposition.
Could I ask?
Yes.
Isn't there a rule in place for a similar rule that deals with game fish? Say if you have another limit of trout or salmon, you can have a written note.
Yes, that is correct, Commissioner Graybill. There is a similar rule. In fact, the WAC language that we're proposing is basically a carbon copy of what's in place for game at this point, for in possession of large game and so forth. So it's an extension of that same language.
Rich, how's that going to work if a person has a two-day possession limit? I mean, how's enforcement going to differentiate between I'm bringing Mike's shrimp home, but I have my two-day possession limit? How's that going to be pursued?
There is. We're going to have to take a closer look at that, because Chair Carpenter, you're correct. There are provisions there to have multiple day limits in certain circumstances. So before we come back for an action, let's take a look to make sure that we're not in conflict with those two.
I see Mike just stood up. Maybe he has, if he may. Do you have a thought, Mike?
Well, there are some circumstances where that would be appropriate, where you could lawfully possess two day limits of your own catch. Commissioner Smith remembers, there are situations where you contact someone on the vessel or several bodies and they say, these additional crab, they belong to my wife, who I dropped off on the beach earlier today, who we can't find. So it does help pin a person down in terms of their story. If it's legitimate, we don't want to have to take somebody's lawfully obtained card. So it helps us sort through the situation.
If I may, the note or the letter or the form that's signed by this man's wife, does it have to, is just a signature? Does there have to be name, address, phone number, social security number? What, how are you going to work that, if I may?
There are a number of elements, as Mr. Childers pointed out, that mirror what's on the game side of the house right now.
Okay.
We can get into that. Close look at that to ensure that we need all of that information. I don't know if we need a signature. What's most important to me is understanding who I need to go talk to if there's some help.
Thank you.
The second proposal is to clarify a unit of gear for crab, crawfish, and shrimp. And the current rule does not cover instruments for harvesting crab, in particular like the castable devices and so forth. So this is almost in there as a housekeeping measure, that where it's there to basically clarify and define what a unit of gear is. We got support on this from the public, two in support and zero opposed. So I think this is, again, it's almost in there as a housekeeping measure, but the castable devices and so forth need to be captured as a unit of gear. So this is a rule change, taking the existing language for how gear is marked for crab and shrimp, and changing the language in the WAC from saying that it's a name and address of the person owning the gear to the actual fisher that's operating the gear. And this is going to help enforcement kind of maybe give them another tool to get at this tending someone else's gear and a theft of gear and so forth. So rather than name and address of owner, it's the, if you're operating that gear, your name and address has to be on the buoy. We did get support, two comments of support and four in opposition. There's still concerns in the crab and shrimp community that if you have to put your address on a buoy, which you currently do, that can open it up to robbers, if you will, knowing that you may be out crabbing and so forth, and then target your house and so forth. So that's been a concern for many years since we've required address on buoys. The other one is it doesn't allow a sharing of pots, which I guess it does put some restrictions on that. But again, there's sharing gear, and then there's this widespread problem that we have of people tending other people's gear and actually flat out stealing gear. And the other comment was we should allow multiple names on a buoy. So maybe they could have several owners and so forth. So that's the comments in opposition.
This may be a question for Mike, but do we know if there have been robberies that have occurred as a result of addresses on buoys? Is that something we can respond to, since it's been a practice for a number of years?
Thank you, Commissioner. We're not aware of any instances. I'm not certain we could necessarily put that together. But to expand on the concern, identity theft, I believe, was the greater concern.
Oh, okay.
We talked about, you know, a number of options to include just simply putting a wild ID number on the buoy. As you know, we have access to people's license information, which includes address, telephone number, with our local terminals. So we've thrown away, thrown around a number of ideas. But the biggest challenge for us is the information is often complete on the buoy. And we wind up having to seize a lot of gear we wouldn't need to seize and handle it as evidence, and it's a big thing.
Thank you.
And I would add to that that it's been a few years, I think it was about 8 or 9 years ago that we actually entertain going with the wild ID, the license number on a buoy, and presented that to the advisory boards, and we didn't get a lot of support for that. But that's before this day and age of all this identity theft. So I think it might be time that we revisit that. I think that could be a useful tool for both enforcement as well as maybe advantageous to the fishing public. So maybe coming forward with that in the future is a change.
Right.
I'm sorry. I hesitated a little bit when Mr. Schulter said that if this would potentially prevent somebody from using another person's gear, if it's unlawful use, we want to prevent that, but if it's lawful use, then we want to allow it. But we need to know who the gear belongs to. And right now, if I want to go fish Mr. Schulter's gear, I just simply take a piece of duct tape, put it on the buoy, cover up his information, sort of semi-permanently, and then, record my contact information on that. And I suppose I think it's important to preserve, someone's ability to borrow gear while at the same time maintaining the integrity of the fishery. So it seems to me there's merit in trying to come up with the best scenario.
The next shellfish proposal is to put in a permanent WAC, a size limit for tanner crab, which in recent years have been showing up in pretty good numbers in parts of Puget Sound, particularly the North Sound area. It will help us protect the tanner crab that are there. And this size limit from the test fisheries that we did will allow the majority of females to be released. Rarely do females get above 4.5 inches or so. So it's targeting mainly the males and allowing the release of females. We got two comments of support and no opposition to this rule proposal. The next shellfish proposal is for coastal fishery, which is implementing a rule that will allow the use of half-inch mesh for a shrimp fishery inside 20 fathoms on the coast, and that would allow the targeting of non-spot shrimp. So looking at providing some opportunity there for some coastal fishing closer to shore. Some shrimp fishing. Got two comments of support and no opposition on this. Allow squid harvest in Hood Canal. There was some precautionary actions taken several years ago in reaction to low dissolved oxygen in Hood Canal to close the squid fishery there. We've been kind of rethinking that and think that it's not, the amount of effort that we're looking at is not going to be harmful to that resource, and we saw no reason to keep that closed. And if we can provide some opportunity for jigging for squid, for instance, on some of the public piers in the canal, we think that's a good idea. We got one opposition and one support. And the opposition was basically saying that squid are, which is true, an important prey item, particularly for salmon. But again, looking at the life history of this animal and the amount of effort or the take is going to be pretty insignificant.
Humboldt squid in Hood Canal, is that a fact?
It is not a fact. It's just covering all the bases.
Oh, okay, thank you. Thought we had something new there, Rich.
This one, a bit controversial. It's restricting the heating of oysters in the shell on the beach. We started a couple years ago getting lots of reports from enforcement that folks were taking down burners and so forth and using those to heat the oyster shell as a means, quick way of shucking. Couple of problems with that, and that is that you, if you're doing that, it's hard to enforce the limit because you're probably eating the oysters and so forth, but probably more importantly, and people don't realize this, is that when you heat the shell, you're killing multiple oysters because oysters set on the older shells. So when we're heating, you have all the young of the year and so forth that you're killing, and that would be the future oysters to be harvested. So we want to put a stop to that, and this is being implemented on not on private tide lands, it's only on public tide lands, the popular state parks and so forth. And a lot of these are areas that we actually enhance with oysters and so forth to keep the fisheries going. So it was a pretty small issue, I'd say 10 years ago, but it's becoming more and more and more popular, so we think we need to put an end to it. We did get some opposition to it. I think the majority of the opposition was thinking this was going to extend on the private property, tidelands, and so forth, which it's not. But some of the comments were that there's plenty of oysters, so it shouldn't really matter. And I guess that could hold true in some areas and definitely not true in others. Some of these parks and public tidelands that were trying to maintain a fishery through enhancement. It does reduce the risk of Vibrio illness. That is a true fact, but you can cook cook the oysters at home. You wouldn't want to eat them raw during the summer months. And the rule change favors private beach owners, which I guess it doesn't impact the private beach owners. And the impact from cooking oysters in the shell is negligible, and I would argue that that's not actually the case, that it does. There can be a fair number of young of the year sets on a single oyster shell, so if you're killing those, we could really see some harm on the beaches.
I don't understand that. Can you explain how it protects the young of the year if they're not cooked on? I mean, if the oyster's going to be taken anyway?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Commissioner Thalburn. That's a good, I should have pointed that out. In the recreational fishery on public tidelands, you're allowed 18 oysters a day. Shucked in the shell has to remain on the beach. And we require that leaving the shell on the beach because that is what recruits the wild stock when they're spawning. The oysters detect that shell in the water, and that's where they settle out.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question. This is, again, in that category almost of a housekeeping, but we're removing a bonus limit of eastern softshell clams in Skagit Bay and for cockles in Willapaw Bay. And this has been on the books for quite a while. And we caught it as we were doing this review of all the shellfish whacks. So the current populations no longer support or warrant these bonus limits in either of these areas. And we got one comment of support and no opposition to this. Additional questions?
I just have one, Rich. The eastern softshell and Skagit Bay, those are... They're not native to that area, are they?
That's correct.
All right. So for the record, my name is Dr. Dave Lowry. I'm with the Marine Fish Science Unit of WDFW, and I'm going to cover the marine fish proposals that we've got for you today. There's only a couple of them. The first of which is to require a descending device in Puget Sound for bottom fish and halibut fisheries. And we've got some examples here of what descending devices are, just so that people can be familiar with them. Essentially, descending devices are a tool for putting fish back into deeper water to offset the effects of barotrauma. So when you bring a fish to the surface, the decreased pressure from no longer having the water pressed down on them causes expansion of the gas bladder. This injures the fish. It can rupture the gas bladder. It can have a variety of harmful effects. And there's quite a bit of science now to show that if you take fish and rapidly put them back down at depth, they can actually survive even extensive barotrauma. So fish that many people would otherwise think were just flat out dead at the surface can actually survive. And there have been tagging studies and a variety of other studies to support that these work. So the proposal that was put in was to require these for all bottom fish and halibut fisheries. We got quite a bit of commentary on this. The pro commentary, the support of these, the use of these tools was that these are good tools, that they do in fact have a benefit to the species. There were a lot of people that said that, yeah, we get it, the tool is necessary, but, you know, it's not really the proximate cause or even the ultimate cause of loss of these fish, that commercial fisheries were the problem, and yeah, I'll go ahead and use the tool if I have to. So it was kind of reluctant support, but support nonetheless. We did also have a couple of people that said they would be in support of using these tools if it remained possible to build your own. And the science on this has shown that there are a variety of now commercially available tools that can be utilized, but you can also do this with something as simple as an inverted lead head jig. You just rig a hook to be hooked upside down on your rod, and when you drop the fish to the bottom, it holds it to the bottom. When you jerk up, the fish is released. So there are some fairly cheap at-home remedies to be able to do this, and at this point, we're not specifying the type of mechanism that needs to be used. We're just saying a descending device. The con for this was that that the proposal basically should wait until we complete other activities relevant to rockfish in Puget Sound, specifically the federal recovery proposal that's going forward, or recovery plan that's moving forward right now under NOAA's auspices. The use of descending devices is actually included in that recovery plan, and it's promoted in that recovery plan. So this is not necessarily out of sync with what NOAA's already thinking on this topic.
I just want to add my voice of support, because as we were listening to the Puget Sound recovery group yesterday, they have been trying to promote this with very little success, and I almost raised it yesterday. What, you know, maybe we need to require this as an important step. So I'm pleased to hear that it's added to the regulations.
Thank you. And I think just as a follow-up to that, last week I was actually in British Columbia for a couple of days meeting with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada, and they're considering doing something like this as well. It's not unique to our jurisdiction by any means. Charter guides in a variety of jurisdictions, California, Alaska, have been required to use these for a couple of years now. There's been a lot of voluntary utilization, but support of that. And between Puget Sound Anglers and WDFW right now, we've freely given out over 2,500 right. of these devices. So we've been trying to get the word out. There's a lot of support for it. This is just a mechanism to formalize that. And we would be the first jurisdiction on the West Coast to require this for recreational fishers.
How expensive are these devices? I mean, if you go to the sporting goods store to get them when they're required, are they expensive?
Thank you for that question. It ranges, and there are options. Like I said, if you're just using an inverted lead head jig, it's, you know, a buck or two.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty cheap. There are commercial devices available. The Shelton Fish Descender is about $6 or $7. There's more expensive options. There are trade-offs between how quick and easy they are to use versus how effective they can be necessarily. But it ranges from anywhere from a few dollars to maybe as much as $40 or $50. But there are probably six or seven different designs out there that have proven pretty effective. And then three or four commercially available that are pretty widely used.
Right. It seems like it may be to the department's benefit to maybe specify a range or an alternative that's allowed. So you're not requiring a $50 device.
Oh, no.
And it could be as simple as the inverted hook, but maybe a definition of what's adequate, what's deemed as adequate, just an idea.
And And we have been having discussions with NOAA relevant to the ESA-listed rockfish recovery plan about how to essentially expand the education and outreach aspect of this. Mm-hmm. We already have several pamphlets that show different styles of devices and make different recommendations. There's also a variety of YouTube videos out there produced both by us and by NOAA Fisheries. So there's a variety of information out there. I think that we can certainly add the advocacy for a variety of methods and try and really focus on the fact that this is not an expensive option for the public.
Well, and given the fact that having one device, you can use the same device repeatedly.
Yep.
So, yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any additional questions? Okay. So there were a couple of additional commentary, and these were just things that kind of came out of some of the comments, neither for or against, but just kind of general commentary. First was that the proposal was too vague, that they wanted more detail. As this develops into WAC, I think it'll be pretty clear. And actually, one question here was, what is meant by a descending device? So I think on that level, we can certainly get into the details and really formally make sure that the public knows what we're talking about. Another comment that was made was that charter vessels, when they catch a bunch of these fish, a bunch of especially rockfish that have the stomach and the esophagus averted out through the mouth, and they have Popeye and all of these other effects of barotrauma, they said these are called floaters. They're left out, you know, for birds to feed on. They still stay in the ecosystem. What's the problem? Well, what's the problem is that this right here is an ESA-listed fish, and that there's a lot of federal management going on with those fish right now, and that even fish that look as bad as this have been tagged, descended, and found later. So we know that fish, even looking this bad at the surface, can survive a recompression ride. So the second marine fish proposal that we have, this kind of borders on what Rich was talking about housekeeping or kind of cleaning up language. There are a few species out there right now that we occasionally see in Washington's marine waters that are becoming more and more common. Part of this is global warming. Part of this is the blob that's been affecting the Northeast Pacific the last several years. But we have fish that are fairly regular residents now in Puget Sound waters for short periods of time. And we've actually had a few of these caught and brought in. There was an issue with OPA last year where somebody landed one, brought it in, and then after the fact, we kind of realized technically you can't keep it. So this is just taking a few of those species, specifically OPA, swordfish, striped marlin, and mahi-mahi or dolphinfish, and classifying those as food fish. So in doing so, those would fall under the two fish per person per day limit.
I'm in favor of anything that brings more OPA to the marketplace.
And that's pretty much what the public said as well. So we only had three comments on this. All of them were pro, and all of them basically said, look, it's a fishing opportunity that exists. People are out there fishing for tuna, and they occasionally run into these fish as well. You might as well be allowed to keep them. At this point, we concur with that. In a nutshell, that's what they said. They said, yep, it's one more thing we'd love to be able to keep. So, and with that, I'll take any questions that you have.
If I remember correctly, we're scheduled to adopt this in December. Is that correct?
Correct.
I would, regarding the descender, which I totally support, I would just mention that getting engaged to be able to go to the sports shows and the boat shows to have a jump start on the process of educating the public, because there's often 70, 80,000 people attend some of those shows, I think would be worth trying to put together up front.
Yes, thank you for that. We've been going to several different major boat shows and sportsman shows over the last few years, and we've developed handouts talking about recompression devices, what they are, how they work, why they're good. We've also got a variety of materials for rockfish identification and for different things like that. We'll definitely be exerting a full court press on those.
I can't speak for any sport groups, but I would suspect that people like Ron Garner's group, Puget Sound Anglers, might even help staff the booth. They like engaging with the public on that. I see Mike standing up again.
Sorry, Mr. Vice Chair. I'd just like to add that enforcement has been handing out some devices for a number of years now, and they are quite inexpensive. You never know to get people expensive items. but
our enforcement stance, provided that this became law, would be to ease into it and make sure that there was good education before it happened.
Yes.
Yeah. The last four species, I assume, are healthy populations in their native range and are maybe benefiting from climate change with range expansion.
Yes, as far as we know, all of these populations are managed under the Highly Migratory Species Group of the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, and the assessments there basically show that they're the portion of their population that occurs in Washington is a very minor portion. Again, we expect that to be expanding over the years as the water's warm, but it's a fairly minor portion of the population right now, and so their occurrence in our waters is seasonal, and that any impacts that we would have from our fishery would be fairly minor. We'll continue to keep an eye on that, though.
So maybe then to wrap up, we'll have the public hearing this afternoon, or after this presentation. Rule adoption, will be bringing recommendations back to you in December, and then again those regulations would take effect in July. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Any other questions?
Craig can go now.
No, I think.
Thanks for coming, Craig.
Thank you.
Bring some OPA back with you.
We do have two individuals for public comment, so I'll call you both up, Lawrence and Ross,
please.
We're on. Thank you. For the record, my name is Lawrence Buckland, and I do apologize. Yesterday's testimony on for myself, I didn't identify myself, so I am correcting that right now. Today, I am speaking with my Puget Sound Angler's hat on. I did bring it. And I'm here representing, actually, Mr. Ron Garner, who is probably getting sunburned right now and drinking tequilas on the boat. So he asked me to step in and be here in support of his descender device proposal, which he submitted under the auspices of Puget Sound Anglers. So in any case, we submitted it. We're here to support it. But there are a couple of points to bring up. First, the proposal was submitted for all marine waters, and as it was written up, it's for Puget Sound only. I don't know if that was in error and an intentional deviation from the original proposal. Mr. Garner, I've been in touch with him. He emailed me this morning at 3 o'clock, and he said, yes, his intent was for all marine waters. We want to be on the high road here for being able to descend all rockfish, and it's primarily rockfish we're concerned about because of the swim bladder issue, to depth. It's a good conservation issue. It's also putting us on the high road when we're dealing with NOAA over their marine protected area rockfish zones that they want to establish. The other concern is, as submitted, it was directed toward four fisheries specifically: halibut, ling, cabazon, and rockfish. Not that there's much rockfish in Puget Sound that's open for fishing. By virtue of changing it to all bottom fish, you now have drawn in the shallow water bottom fish, such as perch, flounder, all those fishes that I started fishing for as a kid from a skiff in 20 feet of water. Do we really want to have a requirement that all of those types of fisheries be required to have this descender device aboard an 8-foot skiff? I think that's overkill. I think there's a better way of avoiding unfortunate law enforcement, inadvertent law enforcement interactions on that issue. And actually, that's all I have on that. I will end it. And if I may, I want to jump into responding for PSA. For the commissioners that aren't familiar with us, we have actually been partnering with NOAA and WDFW on distributing descender devices to include the expensive Sequalizer, which is the pressure-operated, and the little Shelton, which is kind of like the pin that goes in your trailer hitch. And we've been handing those out. We've gotten the money. We've been buying them. We've been handing them out. All the charter operators have gotten them. We've handed them out at LaPush, Nia Bay during the halibut fisheries, targeting the deep water operations. One other point that I wanted to ask about, finish up, on the possession limit issue, I'm concerned that if I am out in my boat and we come to the dock and whoever is on the boat takes my limit and their limit up the beach to the vehicle, are we in violation by not having a written approval to be in transit? And that concerns me. So I will finish. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Lawrence. And Ross, you have the last word here on this.
Ross Barker, South Bend. Apologize, I'm a little delinquent in reviewing all these things, but I won't try to tackle the crab pot issue. It's really complicated. You know, if you and your wife have your name on the buoys and she doesn't want to go for a boat ride and you got your nephew out, now what are you violating the law? I don't know, but I don't have an answer. Maybe you need some more thought. I wanted to comment on the bottom fish at Descender. I think that's good for the whole state. Personally, I'm doing more bottom fishing and more tuna fishing. A little insurance. Salmon don't seem to be doing very well. What I really want to talk about is the no heating of shells. I understand the problem in, we're in the populated areas where there's public parks and so forth. But familiarize you a little bit with Willapa Bay, as you may have determined, I'm a little concerned that Willapa Bay's, the public and the wildlife are being run off of it. There are very few places where you can go and get oysters. Now, we're fortunate enough we own some shellfish beds, but few people do. And there's 40,000 acres of intertide land in Willapa Bay. 10,000 acres of that is called public oyster reserves. Okay, that's a euphemism. The public is not allowed to touch one oyster on that 10,000 acres. It's reserved for commercials to bid on. Thousands of tons of oysters come off of those every time you turn around, okay, every little oyster on every one of those shells goes ashore and dies. And you're going to tell Ma and Pa they can't go down and barbecue 15 oysters. I mean, it's really, this is just getting to be a little bit too much in unpopulated areas. And as far as parks, we don't even have any. So if Billy Ed can find a few oysters and barbecue them on the beach, I think he should be able to. And if there are parks in Puget Sound or someplace where that would be a problem, then you should address it. But let's not run the public out of the place down south. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And that brings to a conclusion item number 13. It is